Hey there, thank you for listening. We're moving away from SoundCloud, and our current and new episodes will now be available at talk.ekdrishti.in. A link to the new site is available in our SoundCloud profile. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach us on Twitter or Facebook at ekdrishti, or via email talk@ekdrishti.in. And now, back to the episode. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Drishti Talk. We're recording on May 15th, Monday evening, with Bhushan Shah. Today, we'll be talking about the textile policy updates, but first, a quick roundup on some news. Stay tuned. Hey, Bhushan, how are you?
Hello. I'm fine, Chirag. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, man. So we've had some interesting news, that's been making its way this week. I don't know if you had a chance to look at this, but the Department of Telecommunications launched an online portal where you can see all the mobile phone towers in your area. Have you had a chance to take a look at this portal at all?
Yeah, I actually checked the news. Basically, this may not seem a very big reform or very big step, but small steps like this make a considerable difference in the long run. The cell phone location of cell phone towers has always been an issue in India. It is like many people do not like to have cell phone towers in their vicinity because of the radiation hazard.
To your point, and I've had a lot of conversations with people where it's the same thing, where a lot of societies petition, the government or the local entities to remove, the mobile phone towers because they believe that it causes harm. And conversely, we have a constant complaint, and it was really loud last year, that India is suffering from call drops everywhere all the time. And so it's sort of like trying to find the balance. One interesting thing about the portal is that they've actually uploaded a few studies and some videos to try to explain that EMF, which is the electromagnetic radiation that comes out of the mobile phone towers, is actually has no links to cancer and other things as well, like numerous studies that have been done to try and sort of reassure the public that A, this is not an issue, and B, if you're worried about something, take a look, here are all the stats, here's when we completed the last audit of the tower, and what the rating of the tower is and how it complies with, what the compliance status is of the tower.
This is a welcome step to counter misinformation because, a lot of people who do not want India to develop, they do such kind of things like they creating panic amongst ordinary people. We see whenever a big project is being built, there is a lot of misinformation spread regarding it. And I guess it is the same case with telephone towers. So this is a welcome step. It will help in countering the misinformation.
Yeah, and one last point to mention here is that even, for example, even though the government and whatever the local entities actually perform audits, and you can see when the last audit was performed and they do a routine, they actually offer citizens an option to request a manual audit. I want one done today, to where, because I'm not satisfied or I think that the emissions are not compliant or whatever it might be. A fee will be charged, of course, but which acts as a good deterrent. Otherwise, people will just start requesting audits left, right, and center. But at least if someone wants that personal satisfaction that, it's been 6 months and I want to get it checked again, then the government's giving that option too.
Yeah, this is a good idea.
I want to add here, it's really great because when they launched the portal, they've actually done a catalog of all the mobile phone towers in the country, which that's quite an expansive bit of work. I want to mention just one additional point since it's related to call drops. Towards the end of last year when there was a lot of hue and cry about the amount of call drops, and I know that this is a problem across the country. The government actually had set up a specific task force to look into this problem, and in the process of which they did a call drop survey, which was released sometime in February. Based on the feedback that they received on the survey, more than 2 lakh base stations have been installed to alleviate some of the problems where people were complaining. So it does look like, some efforts are on. I haven't heard as much hue and cry about it, but of course it could just be fatigue and people are just tired of complaining about it. The number, it's about, I think, 9,000 something cases have been resolved under this, under this because the task force reviews it once every 2 weeks. So I think that number is a bit low because the total number of call drops reported are more than 1 lakh, and obviously some of them will be common. So the progress is a bit slow, but then again, it's the central government along with the state government, along with the telecom entities have to all kind of work together and procure things. But 2 lakh new base stations and to help the problem is actually a good number.
Government has to walk a really tight rope here. It has to maintain a balance between people's concerns on mobile towers as well as dealing with the call drop problem. But I think with the advent of Reliance Jio, which has got unlimited calling, people may not complain that much about call drop problem because it does not lead to any additional financial loss.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. And in fact, the timing was a bit interesting because, Jio officially launched in September last year. So anyway, I hope they continue to publish. The last metrics I saw for this was February. So I hope they continue to publish these metrics to tell us, how many cases are being resolved and how many more surveys are being done. The good thing is that the task force is reviewing all of these complaints every 2 weeks. And they're meeting with the telecom providers. It's once a month, if I'm right. Good that there's something dedicated to looking after this problem. And I think it's probably one of the reasons as well why along with the advent of say a Jio, why these complaints have slowed down quite a lot. I'm going to move to the other piece of news, and this is regarding employment. Job creation is something that's starting to it's starting to create a bit of concern, especially when we look back at the big growth India had in 03, 04, 05, where growth rates were really high, but against that it was what people consider jobless growth. So the government has just constituted an employment data task force. Now, it's interesting to me that actually we don't have quantifiable data for employment today. And so one of the big concerns around this whole question about, how many jobs are getting created? Nobody seems to have this answer.
Yeah, one reason for the lack of answer to this question is that the narrative in India regarding economy is centered around the corporate world. It is not, we don't see the business channels or the economists talking much about the MSME sector. Whereas if you go by statistics, the bulk of the employment in India is not provided by the corporate sector or the government sector. It is provided by the MSME sector. This sector is vast and it is largely unorganized. So the problem is that this sector requires a detailed study, and not much. Many studies have been done by the government with respect to the MSME sector. Now, recently, 2-3 years back, there was a scheme launched. It is a highly publicized scheme known as Mudra Yojana. So this scheme has been particularly targeted towards the MSME sector. They are giving loans to the MSME sector to expand their business. So obviously, lots and lots of entrepreneurs using this Mudra. Yeah. So it is obvious that they will have also created many jobs. But there is, like you said, there is no proper study because the narrative in India is focused around the corporate sector.
The unorganized sector, as you mentioned, which is, where you've had this sort of situation, especially in MSME and so on, where all the dealings were done outside the formal economy, right? So the government can't even see, for example, how many employees exist in certain factories and certain things because there's no record of it anywhere. Even the Labor Department statistics only cover a few sectors. They don't even cover all the sectors. Regarding Mudra Yojana, we've had 4 crore borrowers, right? So it's not a small number at all. If even 60-70% of these people actually created some kind of a sector out of these jobs, and even if they only employed themselves, that's still more than 2 or 3 crore jobs, in terms of employment opportunities that came about. And then we of course don't know inside that, even if they employed one other person, now that number is gone.
Yeah, that is why a proper study of the MSME sector is required with respect to job creation. And I guess the portal which you mentioned is a good step towards that.
Yeah, exactly. And on the last podcast we were talking about the civil aviation policy, and then the skill development behind it, and then how many placements are actually happening. The primary goal of this sort of task force, which was constituted last week, is to actually now try to begin to assess in terms of numbers, really what do we have in India, and then turn around to the government and try and then quantify this data into something that's actionable than at the moment where it's all hypothesis. So next piece of news, which was the health initiatives in action, and I'm really surprised that this did not really merit much discussion in the last week. But there were two separate announcements that came through. The first one was the AIDS announcement. Anybody that tests HIV positive, it will be entitled for treatment, you know, irrespective of the stage. And this is part of India's commitment, you know, to meeting a global or worldwide AIDS goal by 2030. The second item that came up was the pneumococcal vaccine, which was instituted for about 21 lakh children across Himachal Pradesh and some parts of UP and Bihar. Again, the same story. India carries most, the biggest burden, so it's about 20% of the total deaths that happen under the age of 5 due to pneumococcal bacteria, mainly pneumonia and meningitis. So again, here the government has instituted, you know, a vaccine program for all children under the age of 5. It started with these three states, but then it's going to expand to two more and then eventually across the country. But these are two big sort of initiatives from the government side to try and help disease control. But somehow, you know, I came across this news, but I did not hear anything about it in the media.
See, it is a misfortune of this country that the news which you mentioned do not make it even to the headlines of many news channels in India. I guess the only news channel which properly covers these types of news is Doordarshan News, which is unfortunately state TV news channel. It is like if you view Doordarshan, you are uncool.
But you're right. It is almost uncool. And I don't think they have the viewership numbers anyway. We've done a lot of things towards, you know, under the health and family welfare ministry in the last 6 months or so. And these two big initiatives, you know, not getting covered to me seems really odd, and which is why I wanted to mention them today.
As far as AIDS is concerned, we need to remember that firstly, India is the world's number one country when it comes to HIV positive infection. We have overtaken African countries.
It's estimated that we have 21 lakh HIV patients in India. But out of these 21 lakhs, only about 14 lakh are actually known. So there is a big disparity here just in terms of treatment and use.
And secondly, even today in India, there are still a lot of stigmas against HIV patients despite them not having any fault. So considering this from the social justice point of view, it will give the HIV positive patients their due. And it will compensate for the injustice which they have to face in India many times without their fault.
You make an interesting point, because the whole point of the HIV bill earlier this year was to safeguard the right against discrimination in terms of making sure they got treatment, in terms of things like informed consent and actually legalizing all these aspects. Again, it comes to giving these patients their dues. And then they have, you know, supplemented that by actually now announcing that, you know, not only will we protect your rights, but then we will also offer treatment irrespective of your stage because you deserve it.
Yeah, definitely. But we can hope through our podcast and through other mediums on social media, we can make such news mainstream.
I agree. One final piece of news concerning your state, which is the Mumbai Coastal Highway Project. It was a project that was stuck in approvals and legislation for about 15 years.
But this is not the story of one infrastructure project of Mumbai. Many important infrastructure projects have been stuck similarly, like the Sivri Nava Sheva Trans Harbour Link, the coastal road project, even the metro rail project. Everything has been in planning for more than a decade or two, or it has been stuck at the planning stage. Now, the coastal road project is very important because it connects the business districts of Mumbai, which are located in South Mumbai, to the northern suburbs, which are the most populated suburbs of Mumbai. The first phase of the coastal road project will be from Nariman Point in South Mumbai, which is the most important business district, to Bandra in the western suburbs. And the second phase of the coastal road project will be from Bandra to Kandivali. Now, this entire project is going to cost around rupees 14,000 crores, and the total length of this road will be 29.2 kilometers. So if you have ever traveled from South Mumbai to western suburbs by road, you will know how congested that zone is. Because despite most of the road being 6 lane to 8 lane, there is still a lot of traffic jams on that road every day. It takes around 2 hours to go from Bandra to Dahisar, which is hardly 15 to 20 kilometers distance. So this road will take a lot of traffic from the Western Express Highway, as well as from the Swami Vivekananda Marg, which is also another road from Bandra to Dahisar. Hopefully both these roads will be congested. Will be decongested, and I am happy that at least the first phase of the project from Nariman Point to Bandra has got the final environmental approval from the government.
Yeah, it does. So I've traveled numerous times on the Western Highway, And I know what you mean. I have the advantage of visiting by more so on vacation than than being there during peak hours, so I can at least afford to try and manage my time a little bit better. So yeah, the first phase, which is about almost 10 kilometers, which hopefully will be launched in 2019. Devendra Fadnavis, the Chief Minister of Maharashtra, has also indicated that they are working through the approvals for the second phase, so it should be forthcoming. I think there's a specific section on the second phase, which is the Bandra-Versova sea-link bit, which has an environmental component, and they're facing some opposition there.
Yeah, the main problem is the mangroves in Versova. So government has stated that it will try to minimize the destruction of mangroves in Versova.
Right.
And another problem with this project, which is that this project will be implemented by the Brihanmumbai Municipal Corporation and not by the MMRDA, which is the Mumbai Metropolitan Region Development Authority. So now,
right,
if you are aware of the work of BMC, so that will automatically make you a bit skeptical about the implementation of project, but let's hope for the best.
Yeah, I was looking at this news and I saw that, and same thing, like you kind of feel a little bit skeptical, but there's just been an election there, and let's hope that the the new mayor and stuff sort of try to push this. I think for the government, the state government at least, this will become a prestige point anyway, in terms of saying, not only did we get the approval, but then we've, started the construction, started the work, especially at least since the first phase falls within their current, current tenure.
Yeah, because the Eastern Freeway project has enabled signal free driving from Ghatkopar right up to CST. So it has decongested central Mumbai, but it has also reduced traveling time considerably. So now the same thing will be done by the Coastal Road Project for residents of western suburbs and south Mumbai. It will enable signal-free traveling from Nariman Point all the way to Kandivali. So this makes this project very much important, not only from the time, not only because of the savings in time which it will provide, but also from environment point of view, as Mumbai is one of the most polluted cities in the country.
Absolutely. I only traveled the Eastern Highway for the first time about a year and a half ago. So it was completely different experience for me, especially considering I'm mostly, my major route when I'm in Bombay is along the Western Highway. And so it was a massive revelation to get through from one end to the other. I was coming back from Malad, and it was amazing to come down the Eastern Highway to CST, because it took all of, I think it was like 30 minutes or less, which in Bombay is like a gift.
Yeah, on the Eastern Freeway, you can easily travel with a speed of 60 kilometers per hour minimum. You can also take it to 80 kilometers per hour, because the road is a four-lane highway and heavy vehicles are not allowed on the road. Also, two-wheelers are also not allowed on the road.
Yeah, exactly, which is why it was extremely, an uncongested route. Despite me traveling, I think it was close to peak time. So I want to take a minute and thank our listeners for their feedback on previous episodes. We've been receiving inputs. We have a couple of interesting podcasts lined up on topic suggestions that we've received. We are obviously going to keep continuing our policy discussions, and try to bring you more facts about how things are moving across India. But then we've also received repeated requests for a couple of very important topics. So we're trying to work on them, and I hope to bring them to you soon. So our main topic today is a discussion of sort of the textile industry in India. And while we will focus primarily on some initiatives taken by the ministry last year, we kind of need to look back at, India's textile standing globally. And it isn't a very pretty picture. India's current share, at least as of 24, was about 4% of global exports. Even a country like Bangladesh is, at 5% at that stage. So that's not a great, great number. And then if you look even further back, over 20 years or so, India's, textile growth has been about 11.5%. Comparatively, a country like Bangladesh's has been, closer to 20%. So that's nearly double. Textile exports are becoming a larger share of the total. So out of the total things India exports in 2013, about 13% was textile. This number is over 15% now. But the total volume is roughly around the same. So it's not a great picture You know, when you look at what India is, you know, what India produces against what India is able to export or get as a share of the total market.
Yeah, this is particularly disappointing because throughout the period when India has been hailed in the world as the golden sparrow, or rather more famously, the Sone Ki Chidiya, the textile industry of India has played a very significant role in that. India was always one of the leading producers of textiles in the world, right from ancient times till the medieval times before the advent of the British. Even if you talk about modern times, from 1995 to 2000, India was the world's leading exporter of textiles. But after that, due to lack of attention from government and maybe due to some other factors, Bangladesh and Vietnam overtook us. And now currently, China is the world's leader when it comes to export of textiles.
And there are, for example, there are other factors like if you look at the tariffs, so India pays, I think, about 9% plus in, for example, in the European Union. But Bangladesh enjoys a 0% tariff. And so obviously there are certain things probably that can happen at a bilateral level to help India. But it does look as well that, you know, we're not investing enough in India. So the estimation, I think, is, you know, for every unit of investment in clothing, it leads to 12 times as many jobs compared to, say, the automobile industry or, for example, steel industry, where that number is a factor of 30. Yet these are the areas where we've invested, but we don't seem to have invested enough, when it comes to textiles. The one additional point that I do want to make, and I think this is a very indicative statistic, is the way our factories operate. If you look at the statistics where we have factories of less than 50 workers, that's 78% of total textile factories that we have. And if you compare that with something like China, where China is at 15%, so it's a huge gap. And then if you look at those which have, more than 500 employees, only 10% of our factories do that, again, as compared to, say, 28%. So we do have a manpower issue. And I was reading various studies that have been done on, the amount of output where there are more people working in parallel. And then one of the issues that could be causing this is we have something called the Industrial Disputes Act of 1947. And this is obviously a very old act, but a specific section, which is Section VB of this act, actually imposes heavy penalties for factories that have more than 100 employees. It becomes harder to fire people. It becomes harder to shut down the factory. And so that could be one of the reasons why we only employ a smaller number of workers, because from a policy level, this is what has gotten encouraged. Just because the damages are so punitive, the moment you cross 100 workers.
India has very few factories that actually employ more than 500 people. Now, comparing that with China, even the largest garment manufacturing factories in China have a workforce as large as 30,000 people. In fact, even Bangladesh has garment manufacturing units which employ 10,000 workers. In India, the numbers rarely go beyond 1,000 workers. In fact, in India, the garment manufacturers prefer to split their workforce into many units instead of employing a lot of workers at one unit. This basically because they know that they cannot easily fire workers. And due to this, one of the major reforms of this government, which has been announced in the new textile policy, is with respect to contract workers. One of the features of textile industry is the demand varies with season. The peak demand is during the Christmas New Year time. So what happens is, due to seasonal nature of garment industry, in the new policy, fixed term employment will be introduced for the textile sector, and the fixed term workmen will be considered at par with permanent workmen. So this is better than employing contract workers, because when you employ contract workers, the contract workers anyway do not get as much pay as the permanent workers do. Besides that, there is a provision of 240 days under Section 80JJAA of the Income Tax Act, which would be relaxed to 150 days for the garment industry. Also, another important initiative is the government will bear the entire employer's contribution of 12% EPF under the EPF scheme for new employees of garment industry earning less than rupees 15,000 per month, And this will be for the first 3 years.
So it does seem that a specific angle around the policy changes that came out last year are focused on labor reforms and creating jobs. So you already mentioned a bunch of these, and they're important ones. So tax exemptions being relaxed, for employees of the garment industry is a good thing. Again, the government helping out with EPF is great. The issue with the seasonality, and again, this goes back to the Industrial Disputes Act, where when the policy is so punitive for larger factories, it's very natural that businesses, as you mentioned, will split their workforce across many factories rather than have everybody at one factory, which would have been really great for output all over India. And this is not limited to the garment industry. Most companies find sort of backdoor entries using contract workers and stuff to alleviate these additional conditions that come into effect when you cross, for example, 10 employees for offices, and then when you cross 100 and so on and so forth. So obviously this has to be adjusted, and I think this has to be adjusted across all industries. But specifically, as we're talking about garments today, it's a good sign that the government has focused, among other things, on labor reforms when it comes to specifically the garment industry. And they've done this for both what we call the made-ups industries, which includes all the other produced and manufactured things that are not clothing. Where again, there's also the same improvement, which is 12%. Of the EPF, also looking at overtime, adjusting those to meet the needs of the industry.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, Indian manufacturers prefer to open several small factories rather than one big factory. And the ill effect of this is that when the demand peaks during Christmas or New Year, sometime before Christmas or New Year, the Indian manufacturers are never able to meet the demand. And this is one of the reasons why countries like Bangladesh and Vietnam have marched ahead of India, despite having resources far less than what India has. So the fixed term employment, which has been introduced by the government, will definitely help in addressing this issue and make Indian manufacturers more competitive on the global scale.
Absolutely. And the government is looking to incentivize, for the factories as well, helping with the EPF, because then the burden's not on the employer. Again, that's an incentive. But when you look at other state levies and things like that, they're looking to refund some of them and make various adjustments, including the duty drawback. And the idea is that we'll subsidize and help you out so that you generate more jobs. And then if you generate jobs, then the subsidies will stay. Otherwise, you don't get the subsidy. So it's an outcome-driven incentive, not just an incentive.
For this very reason, the government has introduced rupees 6,000 crore package for the textile industry. And out of this 6,000 crore rupees, rupees 5,500 crore rupees will be used to give an additional 5% duty drawback for garments. A new scheme will be introduced to refund the state levies, which were not refunded so far. And besides that, the remaining 500 crore rupees will be for additional incentives under the amended technology upgradation fund scheme. And this 500 crore rupees will be used if someone wants to upgrade his machinery. Now, in the current competitive world, even machines are to be upgraded from time to time. Earlier, if you wanted to upgrade your machine, the government used to give only 15% subsidy, increased to 25%.
The textile ministry, particularly in 2016, has done a lot towards upgrading, various different pieces of equipment. I mean, just 80,000, for example, power looms were upgraded during the calendar year 2016. But the good thing that I like in a lot of these subsidy and or upgrade schemes that are being put out is they are very, very definitive outcome. For example, when you look at the power loom upgrade or even the purchase of new looms and things like that, the precondition is you must install this loom in your cottage or you must install this loom in a shared workspace area only. You're trying to cut down on the misuse that tends to be rampant.
Yeah, so this is an example of the rightful use of subsidies. The government is not just sending those to the poor to win votes, but these kind of subsidies will end up creating more jobs. And when it comes to jobs, one thing we need to notice, one important point which Indian policymakers and politicians have never understood since independence, is that India needs to encourage manufacturing that employs low-skilled and unskilled workers. If you see India's industrial history right since 1950, we have always focused on industries which require highly skilled workers but we are not focused on industries which required low-skilled workers or unskilled workers. And textiles is a sector which largely requires low-skilled and unskilled workers. So this textile sector has got huge employment generating potential. If you see, now if you look at the countries of East Asia, most of these countries of East Asia gained independence after India did. For example, South Korea, it was destroyed by the Korean War and it became free practically only in 1953. Even Vietnam became free in 1975 after the Vietnam War ended. And there are many such examples, but most of these countries have much ahead of India when it comes to GDP per capita and other economic prosperity indicators. This is primarily because these countries focused on simple factories first, which require unskilled and low-skilled labor. So what happened is, as these countries invested in creating simple factories, the simple factories provided a backdrop for establishment of more complicated industries later on. So ideally, what India should have done is, they should have created simple factories like toys and textiles in the initial years of independence. But we did the exactly opposite, and the result is in front of us. The East Asian countries are much ahead of us, and we are considerably behind them today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we should add here that we're talking about countries where, you know, manpower and population is quite high compared in terms of density. So we've got so much manpower. A lot of it is unskilled. A lot of it is what we call semi-skilled. And instead of developing all of this talent, as you mentioned, we focus at the wrong end of the spectrum. The government's initiative here, the 6,000 crore that we've been talking about, which covers two elements. So there was an initial policy update done in June, and then there was an update specifically for made-ups in December. And the target that they've set is essentially 1 crore jobs over about, I think, 3 years, about close to almost 2 lakh crore in exports. And that's the kind of the standing that India wants to be able to generate. What's also interesting is that a majority of the employment when it comes in textiles actually goes to women. And again, when you tie it into something like the Mudra scheme, where try and target about 5 lakh weavers under Mudra over 3 years again. So 5 lakh weavers who would then essentially be employed. So these are not small numbers when we're talking about trying to incentivize and get these people, you know, not just employment, but then also when you look at the, you know, overall output that India can contribute, especially when it comes to things like garments.
In September 2014, the Make in India initiative was launched with much fanfare. But if you carefully look at the initiative, you will feel that even the Make in India initiative initially focused on factories which require highly skilled laborers. For example, it focused on defense, it focused on solar energy equipment,
absolutely,
and so yep. on. So now it is good to know that the government has finally realized what I have said, that we need to focus on simple factories first, and only then can we go for the big factories.
I think to me, this is the most important point that we've been making. I know we're focused on textile, but this is something that when you look at both the elements, which is the employment side of it, but then the output side of it too, focusing here would have generated huge amounts for us in export and GDP numbers, as well as in terms of, we're talking, you know, one plus crore jobs over 3 years that could have started maybe a little earlier. Something as simple as, a 500 crore investment on the, you know, the technology upgrade fund scheme that you mentioned, where they're going to increase the subsidy for 50, you know, from 15% to 25%. This segment alone is expected to create about 12 lakh employment opportunities. This is it's what I would call a pretty, pretty high return on investment for the government. So it's amazing that we haven't done this already.
Yeah, the only threat to the employment is automation, but so maybe even after automation, we may not be able to achieve 100% success, but even if we achieve 50% or 60%, that is still going to be a huge amount of jobs created, huge number of jobs created.
This is it's a much larger point and a little bit theoretical anyway, but I automation does cause some impacts, but then it also, you know, at the end of the day, there are people that are required to look after the automation, look after the machines. So they have to find alternative ways, but it doesn't mean that their employment goes bust. But I think this ties into the next point, which I want to raise, which is regarding skill development. And I think it's something we were talking about quite often, because, you know, we were talking about unskilled labor, but things like, hand loom and all of these other industries where, you know, a small amount of skill is required, and against which you you would generally get a very high output. The numbers in 2016 to me read well in terms of skill development, where the government says that about 8.5 lakh people, you know, were targeted by the end of 2016. Out of which, you know, more than 5.5 lakh were actually placed in, you know, towards jobs and employment. So again, the turnaround is quite high when you look at, you know, 7.5 lakh people were assessed for employment, and, you know, it's about 5.8 lakh were actually placed. Whatever the conversion rate from being assessed to actually getting jobs is very, very high.
Yeah, so that's why, as I said, textile is an industry requiring low-skilled and unskilled workers. So that's why it has got very high conversion rate for jobs.
Yeah, but again, the government targets are quite good. You know, we're talking about hitting close to 10 lakh per year. So we were 8.5 lakhs at the end of 2016. The government hopes to reach 10 lakh per year by the year 2020, and train in all about 51 lakh, you know, people by 2022, with more than 70% of them being women. You know, a small step, but a huge step.
Yeah, so thankfully the government has realized its potential, and now the textile ministry has been given to one of the trusted aides of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. It has been given to Smriti Irani.
Yeah.
So we can hope for the best.
As we've seen over the years, being a woman leader, she connects with women well. There have been some 66, you know, new textile parks that were sanctioned in the last, you know, at the end of 2016. Again, these are big numbers. You know, they're all in the tens of thousands, touching lakhs of jobs that are getting created this way. And, you know, we were talking about the earlier numbers, and yes, we know that, you know, these things still need to be implemented, but I would anticipate that if they stick to their tasks, you know, by 2020, for example, the textile industry alone will bear the brunt of, you know, new jobs.
And another thing to be noted is that the government focus is more on employing women in this sector. The 1 crore jobs which they are targeting, they are going to generate jobs especially for women.
It's good that they're keeping that in mind even at the training stage, and not just, you know, hoping that they'll subtly pop in and be able to do everything that they want. Anything else that you want to mention on the textile policy?
I would only say that this is what we call actual women empowerment.
Yeah, I agree. And I think even if you look at, for example, the Mudra Yojana in general, not just textiles, a significant majority of the people taking these mudra loans are women. You know, I think we're starting to see a massive rise of the small scale women entrepreneurship. It's good that the textile ministry is aligning itself with this women entrepreneurship goals.
Yeah, hopefully the coming days will be very good for the Indian textile industry.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I mean, we know when we were doing the research for this, like when you look at the numbers and how much, much smaller countries with much lesser manpower overtook us years ago, not recently, like not last year or something. They overtook us like 4, 5, 6 years ago. It's a bit disappointing to see these numbers.
So yeah, it's definitely disappointing because it feels like as if a student who has got a capacity to score 80% marks is scoring only 50% simply because these teachers are not teaching him well or because he does not have resources like electricity at night or access to good textbooks and so on.
Yeah, it's a very interesting analogy, actually. And I think we're far below 50%, actually. So again, I mean, you know, it's a good direction. The targets are I think not overly ambitious, but reasonable. So let's see how these numbers add up